The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You're listening to DNA ID, brought to you by Abject Entertainment. Be sure to check out some of the other great true crime podcasts from this network, including The Murder in My Family, Missing Persons, Scene of the Crime, Three Men and a Mystery, Malice, Riddle Me That, All Things Crime, and Zodiac Speaking. All of these podcasts are available for you to binge on right now, wherever you listen to podcasts. Subscribe where you're listening to this podcast so you don't miss an episode.
Episode 8, Pamela Milam. It was 1972. 19-year-old Pamela Milam, known as Pam, was a college student at Indiana State University. Pam was in her sophomore year at the school located in her hometown of Terre Haute, which had a population at the time of around 70,000 people. She lived at home with her parents Helen and Charles Milam and commuted by car to the campus for classes, activities, and social events. It was only a 10-minute drive from the Milam home at 101 Dawn Lane to the school. But for the weekend that started on Friday, September 15th, Pam had moved into the Sigma Kappa sorority suite on campus. It was rush season, and she planned to stay on campus with her sorority sisters for the duration of the busy and fun rush period. On Friday evening, Pam and fellow Sigma Kappa sisters attended a rush party at the former Men's Annex building on campus. The girls had decorated the space for the party earlier that day. The gathering then ran from 6:30 until about 10:15 p.m. At the end of the party, the girls collected the materials they had brought along for the party, such as the leftover food, drinks, and decorations. Pam, who was on the decorating committee, received a box containing some of these items, and along with two of her sorority sisters, left the men's annex and walked to Pam's car, which was parked in lot 22, not far away. Pam put the box of stuff in her car, and the girls proceeded to their next event, a party in Homestead Hall. They caught the tail end of this gathering and were there from 10:30 until just after 11. At that time, the girls left the party and planned to meet up back at their suite in Lincoln Quad to go get a late dinner. Pam was last seen by two of her sorority sisters walking north between the Science Building and Homestead Hall. She told them she'd meet them back in a few minutes at Lincoln Quad. Her car was about 1.5 blocks away. According to one report, Pam told her sorority sisters that she was going to move her car to a parking lot closer to Lincoln Quad, but Pam never came back. The next morning, Saturday, Pam's sister Sheila, who went by the nickname Sam because her initials were S-A-M, got a phone call from Pam's boyfriend Dave. At the time, the family did not know that Dave and Pam were actually engaged. Dave told Sam that he had not been able to get hold of Pam at the sorority suite. Then, in a separate phone call, the Milams were notified that Pam had not shown up for her shift at the library she worked at that morning. It was totally out of character for Pam to fail to show up for work and to be out of contact with her family and Dave. Her parents called the police to report Pam missing, and her father, Charles, started looking for her in places she was known to frequent. He drove around all day, scouring the campus and areas between the school and the Milam home. At 7 o'clock p.m., two of Pam's sorority sisters saw her red 1964 Pontiac Le Mans parked in the 5th Street and Lafayette Avenue campus parking lot, Lot 27, across from the Lincoln Quad. The Quad is a university-owned apartment complex which housed the Sigma Kappa suite where Pam was staying for the week. The car was backed into the parking spot. One of the sorority girls grabbed a flashlight and shone it into the car. The beam reflected off the lenses of Pam's glasses, sitting on the shelf beneath the rearview window. And Pam's purse was visible, sitting on the back seat on the passenger side of the vehicle. Meanwhile, Dave, Pam's boyfriend, had also spotted Pam's car. With alarm, he noted that her glasses were inside. He called the Milams and told them. On Saturday evening, Charles Milam went to retrieve the car and see if it could tell them where Pam could possibly be. Around 8:30, he and his younger daughter Sam arrived at Lot 27 with a spare set of keys to the Pontiac. As he parked, he was approached by a Stephen Warham of 1745 and a half Locust Street. Steve was a former ISU student and was a friend of some of Pam's sorority sisters. Some of the girls had asked him to check Pam's car because they were concerned that it was still sitting in the lot and Pam had not shown up for a sorority meeting on Saturday. But since the car was locked, there wasn't much that Steve could do. As I said, Pam's father Charles had a spare set of keys to the Pontiac. With Steve and Sam looking on, he used them to open the car door and search the interior, finding the glasses and purse, but no clues as to Pam's whereabouts. But, of course, there was a part of the car that still needed to be searched. It's not possible to imagine the sense of dread that Charles Milam must have felt as he stood behind the Pontiac, considering whether to open the trunk. Finally, he inserted the key and lifted the trunk lid. Pam Milam was bound and gagged and stuffed into the trunk. She was clearly dead. Charles Milam screamed. Someone called the ISU police. Sam Milam, just a teenager at the time, saw her dead sister in the trunk. Decades later, she told the Indianapolis Star that this was one of the most painful moments of her life. Police set to work investigating the scene. It was not clear where they suspected Pam to have been killed, but they processed the vehicle as though it was a crime scene. It appears investigators believed from the get-go that the killer might have moved the car. Detectives learned from her sorority sisters that Pam's car was found in a different parking spot than where it had been seen late Friday, which was in Lot 22 in the second row. The location where the car was found on Saturday night, Lot 27, was about a block away from where it had been parked the day before. And they knew that Pam had made it to the car after she left Homestead Hall, as her glasses and distinct handbag decorated with painted mushrooms were found inside, as was Pam herself. Now, if you're wondering how the girls would have been so certain that the car was moved, it's because Pam's car was quite distinctive. It was red, had a missing right rear hubcap, and the front license plate was not state-issued, but a personal plate that read only Jesus in all caps. Yes, Pam's body was stuffed into the trunk of her car, whose tags were emblazoned with the name Jesus. 6 days after Pam was found in the car, police asked the media to publish photos of the vehicle with an appeal from Police Chief Jim Swift for the public to provide any information about sightings or movements of the car from 4 p.m. Friday until the time the car was found on Saturday. It sounded as though perhaps the working theory was that Pam was killed elsewhere after being abducted in her own vehicle. The media leaked that crime scene techs had collected fingerprints and other possible clues from the vehicle. It was reported later that techs took soil samples and gathered some trace evidence. According to the standards of the time, the processing of the car at the police crime lab was by the book, and any evidence found in it was analyzed and properly preserved. Items of interest found in the car were two spools of clothesline, one of which was consistent with what Pam was bound with. There were also two rolls of masking tape found in the vehicle. Police were disappointed to discover that these items would not provide clues to the killer, as Pam's sorority sisters told investigators that these items had all been used in decorating the men's annex for the rush party and had not been brought along by the murderer. He had used what was on hand. Terre Haute police released few details about the murder. Pam was bound hand and foot with rope around her wrists, ankles, and neck. Her hands were bound behind her back. Her mouth had been stuffed with a piece of denim material and, quote, an excessive amount of adhesive tape was around her mouth and chin, according to an ISU security officer at the scene. The tape was normal 1 1/4 inch household masking tape from the rolls found in her car. Investigators described the rope that bound Pam as typical clothesline rope, and the same type of rope was around her neck. Again, more of this was found in her vehicle. It seems the suspect got very, very lucky when he attacked Pam, as she had everything on hand that he would need to restrain her. Pam's car keys were never found, and although her purse was in the car, her wallet and coin purse had both been emptied. Pam was not thought to have been carrying a large amount of cash. The information about the car keys having been taken was intended to be holdback information, but it was leaked by the press. The Indianapolis Star reported on September 19, 1972 that, quote, "Police were unhappy yesterday about a published report that her car keys had not been found and a report that fingerprints were found in the car. Police said fingerprints found were unidentifiable and her killer now would get rid of the keys if he still had them." It's not clear whether this statement means that the fingerprints were smudged and unreadable or whether they had not been connected to anyone on file. The Terre Haute Tribune also reported that one witness at the scene said that the toe of one of Pam's shoes was covered with what looked like sand. The Vigo County coroner, Robert Burkle, told the media that an autopsy conducted at Union Hospital by an unnamed local pathologist confirmed his initial assessment that Pam had died of asphyxiation by strangulation from the rope around her throat or a combination of manual strangulation and the rope. He believed that she was dead before she was placed in the trunk. Her face was scratched up and bruised, and at first it was thought that Pam had been beaten. But Burkle came to the conclusion that the cuts on her face were instead from a sharp taillight assembly inside the car trunk. If she was in the trunk while the car was being driven by her captor, it could explain her face banging up against the light assemblies. Besides these marks, there was no evidence on the body of a struggle, although Pam did have a bruise on her right knee. The time of death was established to be around midnight, Friday night. Pam was fully clothed when she was found, and the coroner's statements reflected that she had not been sexually assaulted. News articles from early in the investigation reiterate that there was no sexual assault and that her clothing was not in disarray. But reports soon emerged that some aspect of the arrangement of Pam's clothing suggested to investigators that she had been sexually assaulted. Some articles of her clothing were sent to the State Police Lab in Indianapolis for analysis. City Police Chief of Detectives Frank Hoffman said the investigation of, quote, "certain conditions relative to the victim's clothing," unquote, precipitated sending the items to the crime lab. He went on to say, quote, "We're taking no chances. We're taking the items to Indianapolis ourselves, personally." The coroner, Dr. Burkle, later admitted that Pam's pantsuit appeared to have been removed and then put back on very carefully, either by her or someone else. I could not imagine what could have clued investigators into Pam's clothes being removed and put back on, other than perhaps something being inside out. But years and years later, it was revealed that a stick and other debris had been found between Pam's pantyhose and her pants. This told investigators that her pants had been removed and put back on, most likely in some wooded area. This was the basis for the theory that Pam had been taken somewhere away from campus, someplace wooded and likely remote, and killed. A stain was also noted on Pam's blouse that would become very important decades later. All her clothing was collected into evidence. Let's digress from the story of Pam's death for a few minutes to talk about her life. Pam was born to parents Charles and Helen Milam. She had two sisters, younger sister Sheila, who went by Sam, and older sister Charlene Sanford, who had married in 1970 and moved to Richmond. Pam was her maid of honor in her wedding. The Milam family had moved to Terre Haute from Richmond during Pam's sophomore year of high school, but she hadn't missed a beat. A piece about her in the Terre Haute Tribune in 1970 says she was an active member of many organizations, the Girls Athletic Association, Y Teens, a church group. She was editor of the school literary magazine, she played the clarinet and the alto sax, and she spent 9 years in the Girl Scouts. Her hobbies were sewing and reading. Pam loved books. She graduated from Honey Creek High School in 1971, where she was a member of the National Honor Society and the class speaker at her graduation. Her speech to her classmates emphasized that, quote, "our future is whatever we choose to make it." She matriculated at ISU in the fall of 1971. She wanted to be an English teacher. Pam also worked at the Southland branch of the Emmeline Fairbanks Public Library, where she was very friendly with the head librarian, a sorority sister of hers. Pam was also very religious and was a member of the Second Presbyterian Church of Richmond. The family attended the local Washington Avenue branch in Terre Haute. Pam was also affiliated with the Jesus Movement of Terre Haute. She was close with her family, and as Chief Detective Frank Hoffman said, quote, "the girl was well thought of. Investigation reveals no ties with the drug culture or hippie element on the campus." Indeed, her sister Sam said that Pam was always a good girl, a rule follower, someone who was responsible and practical. It must have been both devastating and terrifying for the Milam family when Pam was killed. Her sister Sam, only 14 months younger, was also a freshman at ISU. Sam lived at home too, but still, the thought that both daughters could have been in danger that night must have been horrifying. Pam's funeral was held on September 19th at her church. Several of her classmates were pallbearers. She was buried at Mount Pleasant Cemetery. Per the Terre Haute Tribune, quote, "Perhaps the general feeling at the funeral was expressed when one of Miss Milam's sorority sisters left asking, why, why?" Investigators, working 24 hours a day, conducted scores of interviews to try to determine what exactly Pam's movements had been on Friday night and when she had last been seen. They spoke with all her sorority sisters, Steve Warham, the former student, current ISU students who knew her, including Dave, and members of the ISU security force, faculty, and staff. The librarian, who was friendly with Pam, told investigators that Pam had been at work at the library until 6 p.m. on the Friday she had died. We know she then went to the sorority meeting in the men's annex. Several of Pam's sorority sisters, who came down to the Terre Haute police station late Saturday night to give whatever information they could, told police that Pam had attended the meeting in Homestead Hall, but that she had not been seen after that, even though she had promised to meet them in a few minutes. The last time anyone could recall seeing her was when she was walking between Homestead Hall and the Science Building just after 11 p.m. But no one had seen anything suspicious. Some of the girls did note that Pam had parked farther away than usual. According to the Terre Haute Tribune, quote, "She had expressed fear of parking at a more remote location and had said she didn't like to walk a long distance to the car, and her sorority sisters remarked at the fact that her car was not in its usual place." After the Homestead Hall party broke up, the rest of the girls had gone on to a party in Lincoln Quad, but Pam was not with them.
Seeking the truth never gets old. Introducing June's Journey, the free-to-play mobile game that will immerse you in a thrilling murder mystery. Join June Parker as she uncovers hidden objects and clues to solve her sister's death in a beautifully illustrated world set in the roaring 20s. With new chapters added every week, the excitement never ends. Download June's Journey now on your Android or iOS device, or play on PC through Facebook Games.
In Puerto Rico, we call ourselves Boricua. We are proud, passionate, and full of life. On our island, adventure finds you. Strangers aren't strangers for long. The size of the audience doesn't change the beauty of the music. And we celebrate every last ray of sun. Live Boricua.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Police questioned every male associate of Pam's they could find and polygraphed a few of them. This included her fiancé, Dave. He had an alibi for the night of Pam's murder. He was at home with his parents and brother, and he passed a polygraph. None of these men, Pam knew, stood out as suspects. Meanwhile, another incident right on the heels of Pam's murder shook up the campus. On the night of September 18th, a female student named Sharon Harley was walking on the east side of campus around 10 p.m. when a man riding a bicycle slashed her as he passed by. She was treated at the ISU infirmary for a cut to her back and released, but the random attack set everyone on edge even more. Further, police stated that there had been a burglary in a building near the lot where Pam's car was found on the same night of her murder. The break-in occurred at a building near the 5th Street and Lafayette Avenue lot where Pam's car and body were found. They initially investigated as to whether there was any correlation between the two events, but decided against it. It appeared detectives suspected that the break-in was done by partying students rather than the killer. Investigators also considered some other cases in which young women were murdered to see if there could be any connection. They compared notes with an Indiana State Police detective named Sergeant Harold Jackson, who was working on an unsolved case from August of the same year that he said had, quote, striking similarities to Pam's case. On August 12, 1972, Vicki Lynn Harrell, a Bloomington sales clerk and divorcee, had been found murdered. Like Pam, her cause of death was strangulation, and she had been abducted from a college town in Indiana. But unlike Pam, Vicky had been found nude in a wooded area, had been raped, and had the letters KN carved into her chest. She had also last been seen arguing with a man in a bar. Despite this, police were at a loss as to who could have killed her, and they were unable to link her case with Pam's. Vicky Lynn's case remains unsolved. Hopefully it will be, and I can discuss it in a future episode. Back to the investigation on Pam's case. Police refused to comment on the status of things, not even commenting on the number of personnel working on it or the man hours expended. Estimates published in contemporary articles were that investigators had interviewed upwards of 150 people, but no one confirmed this. Police requested that anyone interviewed please not discuss the case with the media. Terre Haute detectives and ISU security staff members were seen searching an old dump a mile from the main campus on the east bank of the Wabash River on property owned by ISU. No information has ever been released about this endeavor, but it is possible that the search was related to a tip that was called in to the Terre Haute PD by a truck driver. This man had been parked at the Wabash River near the ISU campus on the night Pam was killed, and saw a vehicle with a man and a woman in it pull into a secluded area along the riverbank. Unfortunately, the witness didn't see much and could not identify the car, make, or model, much less the people inside. To this day, it is not known whether this was a sighting of Pam and her killer. If it was, it is the only eyewitness report from that night. In another strange development, the Terre Haute Star reported in early October 1972 that the Indiana State Police had called in a Dr. James Benz, a well-known forensic pathologist, and requested that he conduct a second autopsy on Pam Milam because the first one was incomplete. A couple of things are odd about this. One, it had been reported that the Terre Haute PD had not requested the help of the Indiana State Police in this investigation. Second, Pam had already been released to the family for her funeral. Indeed, the Milam family refused to grant permission for this alleged request. The Terre Haute Police Chief Swift stated that the reports about the ISP request for a second autopsy were untrue. It's really not clear what happened here, but no second autopsy was conducted. Then, at the end of September, a possible suspect emerged in a sort of roundabout way. The Indiana State Police discovered that a 20-year-old Florida woman named Ina Stephanie Weiner had been found murdered in her sleeping bag in a park near Salisbury, Maryland, on September 8th. She was killed just a week before Pam. Indiana authorities were interested in this case for two reasons. One, Ina was strangled to death with a piece of rope, which was found around her neck in her sleeping bag, along with her wire-rimmed glasses, both of which harkened back to Pam. And two, the young man she had been traveling with had been arrested in Indianapolis because he was driving Ina's mom's blue van, which had been reported stolen. Ina's father, Milton Weiner, had been looking for his daughter and the van since Ina had left Florida to drive to Canada. This young man's name was Henry Louis King. King was pulled over in Indianapolis by attentive state trooper Tom Strader, who thought the van looked suspicious. In it, he found King, who did not hold title to the van, a runaway teenage girl, and two, quote, hippie-type hitchhikers. King was charged by Maryland authorities with first-degree murder in Ina's death, and Indiana police also questioned him in Pam's case. Here is a quote from the September 30, 1972 Terre Haute Star. Quote, "The state police spokesman also said the Terre Haute FBI office has been involved in the investigation of the King case, presumably because the vehicle was taken across state boundaries. But he said indications are that King probably was involved in the slaying of the Milam girl." This estimation of King's likely involvement in Pam's murder seems to have been prematurely optimistic, because quickly, Indiana investigators lost interest in him as a suspect. As stated in the Terre Haute Tribune, quote, "Unofficial comment failed to indicate much enthusiasm for that line of inquiry, as local police apparently continued to follow other leads." Henry King went on to escape from jail in Maryland while awaiting trial, was recaptured, and eventually pleaded guilty to second-degree murder for killing Ina Weiner. He was sentenced to 25 years. About 3 weeks after Pam's death, with the police steadfastly keeping mum about the status of the investigation and King not panning out as a suspect, ISU announced that the institution was offering a $1,000 reward for information leading to the apprehension of the person who killed Pam. This amount is equivalent to about $6,000 in today's money. Then another suspect emerged who would be considered the prime suspect in Pam's case for years to come. On November 5, 1972, a man attempted to abduct a young woman on the ISU campus. She fought him off and got away. But his next two victims were not so lucky. At 3:59 a.m. on November 8th, a woman walking alone on the campus was grabbed around the throat by a male attacker. He forced her into his car and drove her to a wooded area where he raped her. When he was done, he dropped her back off on campus. Apparently not satiated, the same attacker struck again, also on November 8th, around 9 p.m. that night. Different female victims, same M.O., hands around the victim's throat, forced into a vehicle, raped in a wooded area, returned to campus. This second victim was aware and savvy enough to be able to communicate to police some identifying information about her rapist. And they set a trap whereby she lured him to meet her again, and the police pounced and arrested 21-year-old construction worker Robert Wayne Austin. Terre Haute investigators took a hard look at Austin. His assaults both occurred within a two-block radius of the site where Pam's car and body were found and happened just a few weeks after her death. The Terre Haute Star reported that sources told the paper that one of the rape victims had been held and assaulted for several hours. Authorities proceeded to charge Austin with the rapes, but could not link him to Pam's murder. And while Austin admitted to the rapes, he denied having killed Pam. Austin's attorneys stated publicly that his client had nothing to do with the Pam Milam case and that he had a rock-solid alibi. Robert Austin's 21st birthday had been September 16th, the night that Pam was killed. And he had spent the evening at, where else, a bar, and had several witnesses who would verify that he was at the bar around midnight, which is around when Pam was believed to have been kidnapped. Austin went on to be convicted of kidnapping, rape, and sodomy for the rape at ISU. I was very pleasantly surprised, knowing how leniently many rapists have been treated by our legal system in past decades, to learn that in April 1973, Austin was sentenced to life in prison for the kidnapping charge. Plus, he got 2 to 21 years for the rape and 2 to 14 years for the sodomy conviction. But my happy bubble was soon burst. Austin was released after serving about 20 years. Even though they had failed to connect Robert Austin to Pam's case, at least some of the investigators continued to consider him the prime suspect. The proximity in time and place of the attacks and his similar MO, attacking a young woman walking alone at night on the ISU campus and raping her in a wooded area, were very unlikely to have been coincidental, people thought. Austin certainly seemed like a good suspect in Pam's case, and more than one investigator took false comfort in knowing that he was locked up, even if they couldn't pin her murder on him. In 1975, 3 years after Pam's death, the stabbing murder of another young woman, Sherry Gibson, raised questions in the media as to whether Sherry's killer could be the same person who killed Pam. Quoting from the Vincennes Sun, Detective Sergeant Tom Hill of the State Police underscored the lack of connection between the two murders. He added that the prime suspect in the Milam murder is currently serving a life sentence for another unrelated crime and thus could not possibly be the murderer of Miss Gibson. Hill was almost certainly referencing Robert Austin. I'm not going to get into the particulars of the Sherry Gibson case because it's complicated, but in short, a high school dropout pleaded guilty to her murder in 1977 and died of a drug overdose in prison. It was not until 2003 that the real murderer was convicted after his ex-wife confessed to their complicity in Sherry's death. Okay, enough with all these suspects who raised false hope in the minds of investigators and the Milam family, but who, in the end, had nothing to do with her murder. As we've seen in so many cases before, it's alarming and distressing how many creeps and predators are out there and appear to be good suspects in any given case. In any event, newspaper articles addressing theoretical connections between the Pam Milam case and that of Sherry Gibson revealed some information that had not come out before. And this information directly contradicted what the coroner in Pam's case had maintained from the beginning, that there was no sexual assault. It seems that this may have been holdback information, or possibly information that was not released in an attempt to protect the privacy of the victim's family. But Pam was sexually assaulted. An Indianapolis News article dated March 10, 1975 says, quote, "The state police said Ms. Gibson and Ms. Milam had both been sexually assaulted. Detective Sergeant George Llewellyn of the ISP let the cat out of the bag, basically, saying that because of the similarities of the sexual assaults in the Milam and Gibson cases, investigators were looking for connections. And Pam's sexual assault would eventually allow investigators to solve her case. But first, Pam's case languished for years. In 2001, a new detective named Mike McGuire began to work the case. McGuire was aware that significant developments in forensic technology and DNA extraction had been made, and all the evidence from Pam's case was packaged and sitting in the evidence room. McGuire submitted it to the Indiana State Police Lab for new analysis. Because the evidence was now 30 years old and had been wrapped in plastic, which is not good for DNA preservation, most of the DNA they could extract was too degraded to develop a profile. But the stain on Pam's blouse yielded results. It proved to be seminal fluid. From this, lab techs were able to obtain a profile of the suspected killer that would permit them to eliminate suspects through comparison. This is when investigators learned that their prime suspect, Robert Austin, had been released from prison despite his life sentence. They had to obtain a warrant for his DNA and track him down to obtain a sample. His DNA did not match. Robert Austin, ISU campus rapist, had not killed Pam Milam. McGuire ran the DNA from the blouse through CODIS, and there were no hits. APHIS was also no help. Two partial prints that had been taken from the door of Pam's car came up empty when run against the database, and a print from Pam's glasses, which was now detectable using new laser technology that was not available in 1972, also proved to have no matches in APHIS. Police were back to square one. Pam's case was now more than 30 years old.
Seeking the truth never gets old. Introducing June's Journey, the free-to-play mobile game that will immerse you in a thrilling murder mystery. Join June Parker as she uncovers hidden objects and clues to solve her sister's death in a beautifully illustrated world set in the roaring 20s. With new chapters added every week, the excitement never ends. Download June's Journey now on your Android or iOS device, or play on PC through Facebook Games.
In Puerto Rico, we call ourselves Boricua. We are proud, passionate, and full of life. On our island, adventure finds you. Strangers aren't strangers for long. The size of the audience doesn't change the beauty of the music. And we celebrate every last ray of sun. Live Boricua.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
In 2008, investigator Sean Keane took the position of chief detective of the Terre Haute PD. He is now the chief of police, and he spoke with me at length about this case. When he assumed his new role in 2008, he handed out all the cold cases in the Terre Haute PD files to detectives, but he kept the massive and daunting Milam file for himself. Chief Keane was not even born when Pam Milam was murdered, but he made solving her case his mission. Keane immersed himself in the case file, painstakingly looking the whole thing over with fresh eyes. He created a subfile for every one of the 56 men mentioned in the file by name, tracked them down, and cross-checked them against arrest records in Indiana. There were a few hits, but nothing earth-shattering. Keane was aware that new developments in technology emerged, and in 2008, he submitted the rope found around Pam Milam's body for new testing to detect touch DNA. When the results came back, they were consistent with the DNA taken from the stain on Pam's blouse. This told Keane that Pam's attacker was likely just one person, and her rapist had been her killer. One thing that Keane did right off the bat was ask Pam's old boyfriend Dave to submit his DNA for comparison. This was easy because Dave was now a member of the Terre Haute Police Force himself, working in the juvenile division. Dave willingly complied, and his DNA was not a match to that of Pam's killer. In 2017, Chief Keane commissioned a private lab to use a sample of the DNA in Pam's case to develop a profile. In essence, the lab was commissioned to perform phenotyping analysis. The lab's report provided to Keene in December 2017 was that although the call rate extracted from the DNA sample was low, only 60% or so, which means that it was not a very good sample, the analysts felt confident that their suspect was a male with brown eyes, brown hair, and darker skin. Based on this information, Keene pulled every arrest record in the state between the years 1969 and 1974, 1,100 of them, and looked for suspects who fit this description who had been arrested for a sex-related or violent crime. He came up with 106 men, all of whom had to be tracked down and eliminated. None of them were the guy. This may have been because the image generated by the lab was wrong. The killer did not have brown eyes or brown hair. Although he did not know it at the time, Keene lost months and months chasing a false lead. Keene was at his wit's end. He felt that he had tried everything in this case, from distributing playing cards with Pam's photo to pulling 5 years' worth of arrest records, and had come up empty. Desperate, he sent a sample of the DNA from Pam's blouse to Parabon Nanolabs and requested a snapshot and forensic genealogy workup. To his intense disappointment, Parabon responded that the sample he had provided was inadequate. They were not able to generate a complete profile that would facilitate genetic genealogical research. Keene felt that his only choice was to submit an additional sample from the blouse stain, even though it would potentially have the same incomplete results and waste some of the precious remaining usable DNA in Pam's case. This time, however, it worked. The sample enabled Parabon to conduct phenotyping to generate a new image of the suspect. This one with boyish features, sandy blonde hair, greenish eyes, and freckled, fair skin. And C.C. Moore found that GEDmatch showed that this unsub had a distant female cousin on his father's side who was in the system. This person and the suspect shared 134 centimorgans, which told the genetic genealogist that this was a second or third cousin. But this cousin was only 13 years old and was identified by GEDmatch only by initials. Parabon contacted the adult in charge of the adolescent's account, who told them that this young girl had been adopted and had entered her DNA profile to try to reach out to her birth relatives. And the young cousin in GEDmatch had relatives living in Washington, Indiana. Keene started there, locating and contacting additional older generation relatives to try to establish a complete family tree. He met with one 85-year-old man in Washington, Indiana, who was a relative of the suspect, and another man in his 70s in Odin, who told Keene about two brothers of his and a cousin, all of whom would have been in their 80s. This Odin man shared more centimorgans with the suspect than did the older man Keene interviewed. Mapping out all the known relatives, there were four men who could have been the killer based on age. The family members of the unsub were all extremely cooperative, even though Chief Keene took care to disclose his mission, and several of them even contributed DNA samples. Two of the samples Keene gave to the genetic genealogist just added to the confusion, though. She found that they shared 200 and 300 centimorgans, respectively. This was a very high number given the remoteness of their familial relationship. So it was back to the family tree tracing, where they found out that one brother-sister pair from one family had married a brother-sister pair from another family, making multiple people several generations back in the suspect's tree close relatives. All of this very long and complex research finally eliminated person after person until there was only one man left in the family tree who could have been the killer based on age and location. He was the son of the Odin man's cousin. His name was Jeffrey Lynn Hand. Hand had been dead since 1978. So how to confirm that Hand was Keene's guy? We've seen this before in the Jody Sarin case, episode 7. Jeffrey Hand had left behind a wife and two sons. The only way to verify Hand's DNA was to reach out to them to ask for a DNA sample. Chief Keene arrived at Hand's ex-wife's home in 2019 and spoke with her at length. She already knew that her ex-husband had been a very bad guy and that he was violent, so his connection to a murder case was not a complete surprise to her. This ex-wife, Rebecca, was completely cooperative and willingly submitted her DNA. As for the sons, one of them was reticent because he was a convicted offender and was suspicious of law enforcement motives in asking for his DNA. Nevertheless, he agreed, as did the second son. Once their samples were obtained, the genetic genealogist was able to perform a reverse paternity test. She could detect from the son's DNA and that of their mom whether their father was a match to the DNA of the Pam Milam unsub. And in the end, it was confirmed with more than 99.9999% certainty that the DNA of Rebecca's ex-husband, the boy's father, matched that of Pam's killer. This astronomically high statistical likelihood that Jeffrey Lynn Hand had killed Pam was enough for Keene and for the local prosecutor. Vigo County Chief Deputy Prosecutor Rob Roberts told Keene that if Hand were alive, they would have probable cause to arrest him for the murder of Pam Milam. As I said, Hand's son was a convicted offender in the state of Indiana. Chief Keene noted that had Indiana permitted familial DNA searching, in which CODIS can be searched for the DNA of a relative of an unknown offender, the Pam Milam case would have been solved in 2009. That was when Keene sought permission to conduct this type of testing and was denied because it violates Indiana law. Because Hand's son's DNA was in the state database, a familial search using the DNA from Pam's murderer would have revealed him as a likely family member. So, what do we know about Jeffrey Lynn Hand? Some of the following information is from the Tribune Star, and some is directly from Chief Keene. Jeffrey Lynn Hand was born in Indiana on February 2, 1949. He attended Washington High School in Daviess County, where the yearbook shows him as a clean-cut, good-looking kid. Relatives of Hand's told Chief Keene that he had grown up in an abusive home. Hand met his wife Rebecca when they were just teens. He went into the service for a few years after high school, and the couple lived in Colorado for a time. In 1970 and 71, the Hands lived in Terre Haute while Jeffrey was working for the post office. In 1972, the year that he killed Pam, Hand was working for a Chicago record company as a delivery man, bringing records to stores in Indiana and Illinois. This meant that he was often away from home, traveling around in his vehicle. His wife told Chief Keene she learned never to question where her husband was during his lengthy travels. He was violent and abusive to her. He was never able to keep a job for long, as he was often belligerent and ended up getting into fights. Rebecca raised their three kids, worked a low-wage job, got help from relatives, and kept her head down. Hand was 23 when he killed Pam Milam in September 1972. No one knows whether she was his first victim, but she was definitely not his last. On June 16, 1973, a 22-year-old black man named Jeffrey Wayne Thomas and his 19-year-old wife Carol, who was white, were hitchhiking. The newlyweds, as of 2 weeks, were trying to get home to Evansville from Chicago, where they were visiting relatives. It was around 9 p.m. on a very hot Saturday night as the two walked along U.S. 41 trying to catch a ride. They were near Terre Haute when they got lucky, or so they thought. A young man with boyish features and sandy hair picked them up in his turquoise 1968 Chevy and said he was heading to Evansville himself. The trio spent 2 hours in relative silence in the car until sometime around 11, the man said he needed to make a stop. He pulled over at a small white farmhouse east of Warrenton in Gibson County. This was just north of the Vandenberg County line. At the farmhouse, the young man jumped out, reached under the seat of the car, and got back in waving a .38 special. He yelled at the young couple, "This is a holdup!" They thought he was joking and laughed. To impress upon them exactly how serious he was, the man fired a shot through the roof of his Chevy. He made them get out, and he tied their hands and informed them that he was robbing them. But the Thomases had no money. In fact, they had $1.17 between them, which is why they were forced to hitchhike instead of taking a bus or a train. The following is a quote from the Evansville Courier-Press. Confused and angry, the driver marched them to a nearby grain silo and left them there while he brooded in the house and came up with a new plan. The two managed to get free of the rope and were about to run when the driver returned with a fresh set of wire. "Here's how it was going to go," he said. He was going to leave Thomas's wife here, tied up in the silo, while he and her husband drove to Evansville to rustle up $400 in ransom money. Once he secured the cash, he'd let them both go. The man made Jeffrey tie Carol's hands together. Then he tied Jeffrey's hands behind his back. He put Carol in the grain silo, tied wire around her ankles, and locked her in. Around 2 a.m., the driver drove off from the farmhouse in a 1964 Pontiac with his prisoner Jeffrey in the seat beside him. Carol managed to free herself from the bindings, escape the silo, and run to a farmhouse a quarter mile up the road. After losing 15 minutes because they could not locate the house, police arrived and picked Carol up. She directed them back to the farmhouse where she had been taken by her captor, which was locked. But at 3:30 a.m., the driver returned to the house, which was his own property. Police arrested the man, Jeffrey Lynn Hand, for kidnapping after finding a .38-caliber pistol, a .22-caliber rifle with a sawed-off barrel, and a 9.5-inch hunting blade in the Pontiac. They took Hand off to jail, where Hand spoke with his father and then told police he was willing to lead them to Jeffrey. He led them to the body at 1:30 p.m. on Sunday. Jeffrey lay in tall weeds about 40 feet from an isolated roadway, his hands still tied behind him. He had been shot in the face with a .22-caliber rifle. He had also been stabbed 8 times and his throat cut. He had been killed where he was found. According to the Princeton Daily Clarion, when he kidnapped the Thomases and killed Jeffrey, Hand had just moved to Gibson County from Washington, Indiana. His wife and 3 kids lived with him in the Warrenton farmhouse. In fact, Rebecca was awakened that night by all the police commotion outside the house. Hand had apparently made the irrational decision to bring his kidnapping victims to his own property, where his wife and kids were present. It emerged later that Hand had been fired from his job at George Koch & Son in Evansville on Friday, and he was scheduled to file for bankruptcy in Vandenberg Circuit Court the following week. It sounds like Jeffrey Lynn Hand was unraveling. Now, the legal stuff in the Hand case is very complicated. I'm going to simplify it as much as possible, but bear with me because the result of all the legal procedures ends up being significant in the story of Hand's life. In short, Hand was charged with murder in one county, Posey County, where Jeffrey Thomas had been found, and was charged with kidnapping in a separate county, Gibson County, where he had brought the couple under duress. The decision to bring 2 separate causes of action against Hand in 2 separate jurisdictions would complicate things immensely. A grand jury in Posey County indicted Hand for murder on June 25, 1973. If Hand were found guilty, he would be sentenced to death under Indiana's brand new law mandating capital punishment in 7 specific circumstances, one of which was murder during a kidnapping. Trial was set for the fall of 1973. Doctors were appointed to examine Hand as his defense revealed that they intended to plead not guilty by reason of insanity. Meanwhile, at his arraignment on the kidnapping charges in June 1973, Hand lashed out verbally and then tried to attack members of the media who were present in the courtroom. Apparently, Hand was outraged that his parents and wife's names had recently been mentioned in a newspaper article. Gibson County Sheriff John Mitchell sustained some minor injuries during the scuffle, and Hand had to be removed from the courtroom. He refused to be let outside where the media could photograph him unless his face was covered with a towel. His arraignment was postponed for a few days, and at the next one, Hand, quote, was reportedly incoherent and unable to communicate and failed to appear for his arraignment, according to the Daily Clarion. The proceeding was postponed again while Hand received a psych evaluation. On June 26th, he attempted suicide in his cell. He tried to hang himself by wrapping a piece of cloth ripped from his mattress around a light fixture and tying it around his neck. But his cellmates pulled him down before he could complete the act. He was moved to a hospital cell while his psychiatric evaluations continued. At the trial in Posey County, which was covered extensively by the Courier Press, medical experts disagreed as to Hand's sanity. One expert testified that he found Hand incompetent to stand trial. Another said he was completely sane. There were several people who testified about Hand's crazy behavior. Indiana State Police Trooper Joseph Rhodes testified that Hand had told him someone named Chuck had killed Jeffrey Thomas. Hand was able to describe Chuck well enough that police artists came up with a composite drawing. But police suspected that Chuck was a figment of Hand's imagination. He was never able to articulate anything helpful about this Chuck. Instead, he would go off on rambling tangents about nightmares he was having. Carol Thomas testified at the trial about the terrifying ordeal she had suffered at Hand's hands. Sorry, couldn't help myself there. And several witnesses testified as to a possible motive. Hand hated interracial marriages like the Thomases. In the end, it took the jury only an hour and 40 minutes to return with a verdict. On October 18, 1973, they found Jeffrey Lynn Hand not guilty by reason of insanity. According to the jury foreman, the jury was swayed by testimony of three medical experts as to Han's insanity, as well as testimony regarding his history of mental illness. Han was remanded to jail to await trial on the kidnapping charges. But in November 1973, he was moved to the maximum security area of the state reformatory at Pendleton. This was because in a lesser security facility, he had attacked and severely beaten another inmate. According to authorities, this inmate was nearly killed. Han spent all of 1974 institutionalized. In 1975, authorities were still planning to prosecute him on the kidnapping charges. Hearings were held to determine whether Han was mentally competent to stand trial, and Judge Ernest Tilley ruled that he was competent based on reports from psychiatrists who had examined him. Yet, in August 75, Han's attorneys filed a motion to dismiss the kidnapping charges once and for all. It's complicated, but essentially they argued that if Han was deemed insane on the murder charges, the same should hold with regard to the kidnapping, which stemmed from the same incident. And they pointed out that it all should have been addressed in one trial rather than trying Han twice for the same actions. The defense won. In a stunning ruling, Judge Tilley declared that because the murder charge was so related to the kidnapping charge, the insanity verdict should apply to both. Han would not be tried for the kidnapping. Instead, in August 1975, he was sent to the Norman Beatty State Mental Hospital under a temporary commitment order. Gibson County Prosecutor George Inkenbrand lamented the ruling, saying, quote, "How long he will remain in a state institution is strictly up to the mental health department as they see fit." And boy, was he right. In a colossal screw-up, the state's attorneys missed the 10-day deadline to move that the temporary commitment be made permanent. Per KFGO, quote, "When the state of Indiana realized their mistake 45 days later, they filed for Han's permanent commitment to the state hospital, but it was too late. Han's legal team was threatening a lawsuit for false imprisonment, and the state flinched." Jeffrey Lind Han was released in June 1976 after spending a mere 3 years in custody for kidnapping and murder in the Thomas case. He went back to his wife and kids, now living in Washington, Indiana. He would not turn back up until 1978. Most of the coverage of this final incident involving Jeffrey Lind Han comes from the Kokomo Tribune. On the snowy morning of January 24, 1978, 25-year-old Susan Matlock went to Block's department store to pick up a few things. This was at the Markland Mall in Kokomo. As she left the store, she saw a young man standing near the exit. She smiled at him and walked to her car. The young man began to follow her as she made her way through the parking lot. As she neared her 1977 Pontiac Firebird, he attacked her and pushed her into the car. This surprise attack was rough enough to alarm a clerk in Blocks, who was observing all this through the store window. She had noticed the man in the store watching the young woman while she shopped. The clerk called the Kokomo PD and told them she had just seen what looked like a man abducting a woman. Meanwhile, in the car, a terrified Susan Matlock cowered as a man threatened her with a gun and knife he said he was carrying. He told her that he had no compunction about using the weapons and he had just robbed someone else. He sat in her driver's seat and hesitated, apparently not sure of what his next move should be. He told his victim that he needed to get to South Bend. Susan tentatively offered to drop him at the bus station. The man angrily told her to sit in the passenger seat and act like they were together. He pulled out a gun to show her he meant business. Meanwhile, he could see the clerk on the phone in the store, gesturing, and realized that she was probably calling the police. He drove Susan's car to another store and parked in the lot. But Kokomo police were already on the lookout for the Firebird, and they spotted it quickly. Kokomo police officer Jerry Castle drove up behind the Pontiac in a squad car. This spooked the abductor, who drove Susan's car off toward 17th Street, with her sitting in the passenger seat, no doubt petrified. Officer Castle called for backup and pursued the Firebird. Howard County Sheriff's Deputy Vernal Baugh heard the call come through on the scanner and joined in the pursuit. On State Street, the abductor skidded on the snowy roadway and lost control, jamming the car into a snowbank. He got out and ran. Officer Castle pulled over and made sure that Susan was okay. Meanwhile, Deputy Baugh chased the running man, trapping him in an alley using his car as a barrier. He ordered the man to stand still with his hands on his head and got out. He reached into his car for the radio. As he did this, the man pulled out a gun and shot the deputy in the right hand and again in the left side. Baugh, under fire and yelling, "I'm hit, I'm hit," managed to shoot the suspect in the shoulder. The shot punctured his lung, but that did not stop the man from running again. After firing at Baugh three more times and missing as Baugh dove into a ditch, the man dashed along some railroad tracks, and Castle, pulling his gun, fired three shots at the man running from him. The man went down, managing to slip underneath a stationary train boxcar and out the other side. He ran about 30 more feet before collapsing in the snow and dying. The dead man was Jeffrey Lynn Hand. In Hand's pockets and his wife's car, found parked near the mall where he had attacked Susan, were found the following items besides the gun and knife he was already carrying: a long piece of rope, stocking caps, masking tape, bandages, ammo, sunglasses, flashlights, leather gloves. And one odd thing, photos clipped from local newspapers of recently engaged couples, just like the young couple he had kidnapped and destroyed in 1973, the Thomases. As Kokomo PD Major Jim Calabro stated, quote, he had a whole bag of tricks in his car. There is zero doubt that Jeffrey Lynn Hand intended to abduct and rape Susan that day in 1978, as he had done with Pam Milam 6 years earlier. His MO was most likely the same: loiter unnoticed in an area frequented by young women, select one as his target, and pounce on her as she walked to her car. Then drive somewhere remote and rape and kill his victim, returning the car to the area where the abduction occurred to retrieve his own vehicle. It all fits. Chief Keene believes that Hand likely used a gun to coerce Pam to go with him quietly, the way he did with Susan. But, of course, in 1978, when Hand tried to abduct Susan, no one knew about his murder of Pam, and they wouldn't for another 41 years. On May 6, 2019, Terre Haute Police held a press conference to make an announcement in Pam's case. Her sisters Charlene and Sam, now in their 60s, were in attendance. At the press conference, Chief Keene spoke for about 50 minutes, laying out the facts of the case and the processes he went through to identify Pam's killer. He concluded with a comment that he hoped that other law enforcement agencies would embrace forensic genealogy, crediting its scientific method of crime solving as an invaluable tool. Charlene Sanford, Pam's older sister, thanked Chief Keene for his, quote, persistent and meticulous work and determination to solve it. It's been a long 46 years, 7 months, and 20 days. Many of us, as we got older, thought we would die before we ever learned who had killed our sister. She added, quote, we were happy to know he hasn't been out there living a great life for 47 years. Charlene thanked all the detectives and others who had worked her sister's case over the years. She even thanked, quote, the murderer's family who so willingly cooperated with police. Sam Milam spoke next. She said eloquently of her sister Pam, quote, none of us were the same without her life-affirming generous spirit that was replaced by the presence of another person's malevolence and cruelty. Referring to the solve, she said, quote, I wish my parents could have seen that, because that would also have given them a little more peace in their life. Sadly, both Helen and Charles Milam had passed away and did not live to see their daughter's case solved. Charlene told a reporter that while their mother allowed her pain and grief to show, their father internalized it. Charlene said in an article in the Indy Star, quote, I know for a fact he would go visit the cemetery sometimes and not tell anybody. I think his nightmares must have been horrible, but he didn't let it show. After the press conference, in an interview with NBC Channel 2, Charlene said that although she does not like the word closure, there is a sense of closure learning that Jeffrey Hand was killed 6 years after Pam's murder. Being shot by police is somewhat the appropriate end for him, she said. Even though Jeffrey Lynn Hand is long dead, investigators are still working to determine whether he is responsible for any other crimes. He traveled around quite a bit in his record company job and otherwise, and his wife told investigators that he was gone for long stretches of time without explanation. It seems that a man who will grab a young woman in a parking lot in public, which he did twice that we know of, is brazen enough to do almost anything. Hand was an opportunistic predator, attacking Susan and Pam and picking up the Thomases because they were all in the wrong place at the wrong time. He does not seem like an organized offender who brilliantly covered up his crimes. Chief Keene believes he likely has more victims. Authorities are looking into an unspecified murder in Wisconsin to see if he was involved in that. Chief Keene also notified authorities in Colorado that Hand, who lived in that state for a time, is a multiple murderer. Closer to home, Indiana State Police are investigating whether there is any connection between Hand and the 1977 murder of Indiana University student Ann Harmeer. Ann, who was a theater major and dedicated actress, disappeared in September 1977. Her Pontiac was found with the hood up on the side of Indiana 37 near Martinsville. A witness saw someone pull over to pick her up. Her body was found in a nearby cornfield in October of that same year. She had been strangled to death. During this time period, Hand was living in Washington, Indiana, having been released from the mental hospital in 1976. If Hand was responsible for Ann's death, that would make three known victims or intended victims of Hand's who drove Pontiacs: Ann, Susan, and Pam. After 47 years, Pam Milam's case is finally solved thanks to forensic genealogy. And if you were one of the bad guys, they are coming for you. Special thanks to Chief Sean Keene of the Terre Haute PD for speaking with me about this case. I'd now like to play for you a preview of a podcast I think you'll like called The Path Went Chilly.
Hi, I'm Robin Warder from The Trail Went Cold. If you are unfamiliar with my other podcast, I often cover stories from the television show Unsolved Mysteries. For the past 5 years, you've heard me talk about these cases on my own, but now's your chance to hear me have in-depth discussions about them with other people. I want to welcome you to my new project, The Path Went Chilly, where I will be discussing in depth with my two good friends and co-hosts cases that I've covered on The Trail Went Cold. Meet my co-hosts. First one up is Jules.
Hi, I'm Jules from the podcast Riddle Me That True Crime, and I have a PhD in transpersonal counseling. I'm not a psychologist or a diagnostician, so don't get too excited. But I can't wait to analyze these cases with these two amazing humans. You've already met Robin, now meet Dr. Ashley Wellman.
Hi, I'm Ashley. I have a PhD in criminology, law, and society, and I specialize in trauma victims and survivors. I've spent a great deal of time working with families left behind after homicides with a cold case unit based out of Florida, and I'm also a professor of criminology. I'm so excited to be chatting with two of my best friends about the cases that everyone can't seem to get enough of.
We hope in doing so that we will have a clearer perspective of what may have transpired. Oftentimes, Ashley will be totally in the dark.
Jules and I will be telling Ashley a story she may not know much about, so all of her reactions are genuine.
We will be releasing on all major platforms April 8th.
We hope you will join us as we attempt to heat up some ice-cold cases.
The Path Went Chilly will be available every Thursday on all major podcast platforms.
DNA ID is researched, written, and hosted by me, Jessica Betancourt. It's produced by me and Mike Morford of Abjack Entertainment. Music composed by Connor Betancourt. To contact us, you can email the podcast at dnaidpodcast@gmail.com. Or follow us on social media. You can find us at DNA ID Podcast on Instagram, at DNA ID Podcast on Twitter, and on Facebook at DNA ID Podcast. Check out our other collaborative podcasts, Scene of the Crime and Missing Persons.